When is a healthcare bill not a healthcare bill? How about when it's a tax bill? I'm here all week, folks, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 14th of March. Glad you could be with us, everybody. All right, so here we sit deep, oh so deep, in saturation coverage of the Congressional Budget Office's scoring of the Republican health care plan. The details, should you need the refresher, are 24 million people without insurance over the next decade, nearly $900 billion less spent on Medicaid, and $337 billion cut from the deficit over the same period of time. But here is another way to think of this legislation that is designed to re-engineer almost 20% of the American economy, not as a health care bill, but as the first step in the GOP's plans for tax reform. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein gets us going from the help desk at WHYY.
Health insurance costs money, so Congress raised taxes on industry groups like insurers, drug makers, and medical device manufacturers, as well as Americans earning $200,000 and up. And this is what the country got for all of that money, says Gordon Merman with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
The big improvement from the Affordable Care Act was extending health insurance coverage to millions of people.
But now, Ryan's plan would roll back $600 billion in taxes over 10 years. Nearly half of the benefits would go to the wealthiest Americans. Many Republicans believe tax cuts are the best way to boost economic growth because that money fuels investment and creates jobs. Doug Holtz-Eakin ran the CBO under George W. Bush.
There is no public policy, Affordable Care Act, American Health Care Act, that can compare with an economy that grows faster. Tax reform is one way to get there.
Harvard economist Kate Baker says, yes, Obamacare worked at a price. And that's a trade-off, she says, we now all must consider.
When you take money from higher income, healthier people and give it to lower income, poorer people, the main benefit is that those low income, poor people get more health care. And it comes with the cost of a little bit slower economic growth.
Baker says under the GOP repeal plan, the size of the economic pie would probably be a bit bigger. The tough question is whether that's worth the cost of millions losing their insurance. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We're going to detour now into a supply chain story. It comes to us courtesy of the automobile industry. Intel announced this week it's buying the Israeli company Mobileye for about $15 billion. It's all part of the chipmaker's attempt to become a leader in the development of self-driving cars. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
The Intel deal is fuel for those who say the tech industry will take over car making. But, says David Laker of wealth investment firm Robert W. Baird,
as these tech companies are looking into auto space, or the auto companies looking into tech space,
automakers have been slow to get new technology into cars. Laker says that's largely because the technology has to be really robust and work in vehicles in all kinds of conditions.
In a car at 25 below zero, 120 degrees above zero, lasts for 10 years without any real changes.
As for tech companies, they tend to release consumer products on a breakneck timeline and expect more immediate results. That's fine if you're making smartphones or flat-screen TVs, but when your technology is steering a car and people's lives depend on it, you'd better get it right. Sam Abuel-Samid is a senior analyst with Navigant Research. He says car makers are eager to acquire tech knowledge because if an autonomous vehicle crashes, they could be liable.
They can make sure they get it properly validated and tested. They don't want to have to be dependent on someone else for that guarantee of performance once these systems are out on the road.
And he says acquiring high-tech expertise and the companies who have it gives them greater market share and less risk. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Let's say, just for fun, you were in the market to buy a big-name retailer, no questions asked. Well, today is your lucky day. The private equity outfit that owns 100-year-old Neiman Marcus has hired advisors to shop the company around. So far, so good if you're buying, right? Yeah, but here's the catch. Neiman comes with a whole lot of baggage, including almost $5 billion in debt that is rated at junk. Oh, and also, in this age of internet retail, what exactly is the appeal of owning a high-end department store like Neiman? Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
Neiman Marcus is facing the same problem as other department stores. People want to shop online, especially younger customers. Alexander Chernev is a professor of marketing at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management.
They seem to have problem attracting new customers, millennials. And without an influx of new customers, it's actually very difficult to sustain a business over time.
But as a luxury brand, Neiman has something to offer a potential purchaser, access to a high-end customer base. Many of them are baby boomers with expendable income. And Leon Nicholas from Kantar Retail says these customers may soon have even more cash to spend.
Given expectations in the next several years for, in some sectors, for a rebounding economy and, personal tax cuts and things like that, the expectation is a lot of that money would flow to that higher-end shopper.
Neiman Marcus also has something other department stores have lost over the years, a name with cachet. Carol Speakerman is president of Speakerman Retail.
Neiman still epitomizes luxury and high-end shopping and exclusivity. Arguably, you look at other retailers like Macy's. Macy's perhaps has been a little bit more diluted in that regard.
Speakerman says a buyer, especially one with a portfolio of other retail companies, could cash in on that prestige. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
For those who were wondering, which I know was all of you, yes, the Federal Open Market Committee did meet today, East Coast snow and all. Interest rate decision and a press conference by Chair Janet Yellen come tomorrow. Wall Street, meanwhile, more down than up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to talk Brexit a little bit later on in the program, but we're going to go to the Netherlands first, where general elections tomorrow are the most proximate threat to the European Union. Geert Wilders leads the far-right anti-Islam, anti-immigration, and anti-EU party for freedom. So from the lakeside town Volendam, which is a Wilders stronghold, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the story.
For almost 100 years, the de Boer family has run this little business in Volendam.
And smile, here he comes, one, two. I take two more photos. One, two.
Cornelius de Boer takes photos of tourists after dressing them up in traditional Dutch costume, wooden clogs and high-pointed bonnets, and seating them next to a homely Dutch hearth.
I'm selling an image of the Netherlands, how it used to be, and they still love it. Yeah, they always love it.
With its old fishing boats in the harbour, Volendam is awash with tradition. No surprise, then, that it's also a bastion of support for the hard-right nationalist politician Geert Wilders, although Cornelius doesn't share the local enthusiasm for him.
Too crude. And I think he's a small dictator.
But there's a lot of people here that would disagree with you on that.
Yes, I have a lot of friends who love him.
The man who runs this small pickled herring factory in Volendam is one of Wilders' more ardent supporters.
My name is Sterk, first name Theo. I'm 58. I'm the manager of this company.
Sterk says he strongly supports Wilders' anti-immigration policy and especially his call for no more immigrants from Muslim countries.
They have to integrate, not start a community within a community.
You feel that many of them do not integrate.
They don't want to integrate, especially the Moroccans. They are a problem. They are a burden.
Dutch Moroccans comprise only 2.3% of the population, but in percentage terms they do record higher levels of crime, unemployment and welfare dependency. Sterik claims that Wilders is the only leading politician here prepared to talk about this.
He is the only one, and he addresses the problems we have.
To his many critics, however, Geert Wilders is a racist and a rabble-rouser. Last December, he was convicted of inciting discrimination at this political rally.
Meer of minder Marokkanen?
Do you want more or fewer Moroccans? He asked the crowd. Fewer, fewer, his supporters chanted. We will arrange it, said Wilders. Many pundits have united to deride his political program. It covers just one sheet of paper and includes closing all the mosques, banning the Quran, withdrawing from the European Union, cutting income tax and spending more on defence, all at no extra cost to the public purse.
It's completely ludicrous, as most economists would agree.
That's Professor Sweda van Weinbergen of Amsterdam University, and here's Bas Jacobs of Erasmus University in Rotterdam.
This is not to be taken seriously at all, period.
But we should take Wilders himself seriously. He probably wouldn't be able to form a government after this week's election. He'd need a coalition, and almost all the other parties will have nothing to do with him. But Jan Paternotte, a candidate for the D66 party, says a big surge of support for Wilders could further boost the anti-immigrant, anti-EU National Front leader in next month's French election.
That will send a message to the French that also the Netherlands has really given populism an even stronger voice. And that might, of course, help Marine Le Pen.
The weekend's violent clash between Dutch police and Turkish protesters in Rotterdam has helped Wilders and could even help Marine Le Pen. It stirred a potent brew of anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-EU feeling. No sign yet that the populist tide that could threaten European prosperity is turning. In Rotterdam, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Raise your hand if this has happened to you. You're cooking and you start a recipe that says it takes, say, 20 minutes. But there you are, still standing there an hour later because you had to caramelize the onions. Tom Skoka writes for Gizmodo and has made it his personal mission to bring caramelization truth to the internet. The headline on his most recent piece is Google's algorithm is lying to you about onions and blaming me for it. But really, it's about more than just the onions. Tom, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about caramelized onions, man, because honestly, it's probably one of the biggest lies in cooking, right?
It is. About 5 years ago, I finally reached my boiling point about this fact. I was reading a recipe in the New York Times. It wasn't even a recipe that I meant to cook. I think it was a recipe for some savory scones, but it said that if you chopped up your onions and you threw them in a pan and you cooked them for 5 minutes and then you cooked them for 5 minutes more, you would have golden brown, sweet caramelized onions to put in your scones. And I said, no, you won't. You won't be anywhere near it. Most of an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, depending on how hard you do it. And so I had seen things like this over and over again. So I wrote an article for Slate about it where I actually tried to cook caramelized onions as fast as I could. And on high heat, I got it done in like 29 minutes, but it was miserable. You're just like stirring like crazy to get it done. So I wrote about this, about how all these recipes always lie about how long it's going to take.
Exactly. So you're right about it in Slate, and now here comes this piece in Gizmodo headlined, Google's algorithm is lying to you about onions and blaming me for it. Tell me about that.
Right. So I wrote the Slate piece, and it was actually sort of a success. It got the New York Times to change its approach to writing about onions. I kept hearing from people who had thought they were bad cooks and then learned that, in fact, they had just been following bad recipes. And so, you know, I had put this down as a little bit of progress against the darkness of falsehood.
Rage against the machine. But then you noticed. Yeah.
So I read these articles that were coming out in the last week or two about how Google has this new feature that's supposed to give you the one true answer to a question you type in. Instead of just feeding you a list of things, it pops out in a big box and tells you what the answer is. And the problem is that people discovered that if you ask it if Barack Obama is planning a coup d'etat against the U.S. government, it says, yes, he is. If you ask it, is MSG poisonous? It says it certainly is, because bad information that people passionately believe in has a way of rising to the top.
Right.
So when I saw this, I thought about the onions again, and I thought about how this was a false thing that there was a lot of information about. So I typed in, how long does it take to caramelize onions? And I was shocked by what I got, because not only did it have the wrong information, it had the wrong information because it was citing my piece.
Now, we should say that in the days, week or so since this post was published, Google has, in fact, changed the search results, right? So you've changed two things. You've changed the New York Times and you've changed Google.
Right. Unfortunately, it's not really that uplifting, because I'm assuming that this required some manual intervention on their part. Because what happened was its automated information sniffing system just went in, found this article that I guess people had pointed to as something about how long it takes to do this. And then it saw that at the top of the piece, it talks about taking 5 minutes and then taking 5 minutes more, which should mean 10 minutes, but Google just said, it takes 5 minutes. So a piece that was meant to debunk bad information ended up bunking it instead.
But I've never heard that, bunking it. So do you still deal with caramelized onions, or do you just skip recipes with caramelized onions in them?
I throw them in the crock pot overnight.
Oh, that's so smart.
They come out a little juicy, and you might need to like dry them out in the pan a bit before you actually use them, but it's a lot faster.
Tom Skoka, he's a special projects desk guy at Gizmodo. Tom, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
we're going to have an embedded presence in this league to really play some offense.
Sports branding metaphors gone wild. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 44 points, 0.2%, 20,837. The NASDAQ down 18, 0.3%, ended things at 5,856. S&P 500 down 8 points, 0.3%, 23,065. Volumes were light, what with the East Coast battling its winter storm. That made for a bad day for airlines. American Airlines down 2.7%, Delta off 2.25%. Bill Ackman, he of Pershing Square Capital Management, sold his hedge fund's 8% stake in Valeant Pharmaceuticals at a $4 billion loss this morning. Ouch, Valeant closed down 10%. Valeant, you might remember, has been dogged by questions about its accounting and strategies, including acquiring popular drugs and then subjecting them to dizzying price hikes. Bonds rose ahead of the FOMC meeting. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.60%. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about all the things we talk about on this program every single day,
technology, the economy, pop culture, politics, check out our podcast, Make Me Smart.
Molly Wood is my co-host.
Or maybe Kai Rizdahl is my co-host.
I don't know. Maybe. We've got new episodes every week.
And we have live Facebook videos and all kinds of other great stuff for you.
Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
And please follow us on Twitter for more. I am at Molly Wood.
And I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Check it out.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is still, last time we checked, a global economy, recent political events here and in Europe to the contrary. That does get us to the UK, though, and what the future might look like. After a couple of votes in Parliament this week, Prime Minister Theresa May now has the green light to start negotiating Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. But as the BBC's Matthew Price shows us from the town of Worthing, down on the south coast of England, there are going to be a whole lot of pitfalls.
The sound is of glass vials the size of a thumbnail being put through a labelling machine at Allergy Therapeutics in Worthing. And the story of these vials shows you that Britain's drug industry is part of an integrated system. Inside the vials is a clear liquid. It starts as a histamine.
We import that from Germany.
That's Bev Lees, the operations director.
It will already have been tested in an EU country.
And that means
we can then accept those test results that are done in Germany when we bring it into the UK.
They use the histamine to make a drug that treats wasp and bee stings. The vials coming out the other end of the machine have labels in Italian. The drug is being sold back to mainland Europe. But first, it needs to be tested.
The test results that we obtain from testing the drug product are accepted into other European countries without them having to recertify.
You can understand why any major disruption to this system would be a problem, and it would be costly. Take a listen now to Nick Weichmann, the finance director. What if, after leaving the EU, they had to test twice?
Presumably within the EU itself, there will be still be the same arrangement, so we would continue. But if we were to say, for instance, want the product in the UK market, we would have to carry out another set of trials. And that can cost anywhere between maybe 15 to 20 million, maybe more.
And that's a significant proportion of your business operating profit.
Absolutely. We have sales of getting on for 50 million a year. It's a significant chunk.
Next for those vials is a trip from Worthing by road to Dover, ferry to Calais and on to Milan in Italy, in a container that can keep them at between 2 and 8 degrees Celsius for a number of days only. If the journey takes too long, the vials won't arrive in a usable condition. And this is another worry for the industry. What happens if customs checks are put in place after we leave the EU and slow down shipments? In specialist areas like gene and cell therapy, it's even more important to get this right.
In some cases, we will have biological products which will be supporting a gene treatment, gene therapy system, that will need to be held in minus 70 degrees centigrade.
This is Dr. Ginny Archer, who's taking a lead role in Brexit policy work at the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry.
And there are other products, say, for example, tissue samples or viral vectors, where they will have a half-life of hours. So we ship them by airplane right now. So even a delay of 2 or 3 hours can really make the difference between a product that you can use and a product that you have to bin.
Back beside the seaside and the seagulls in Worthing, this is a place whose survival depends on exporting, much of it to the pharmaceutical sector and much of it to the EU. So Worthing's future very much depends on the precise nature of our relationship with the rest of the EU once we leave.
The BBC's Matthew Price in the south of England. Today in corporate branding news, basketball. The NBA is making some changes to its second-tier program, the Developmental League, shortened in the vernacular to the D League. It shall henceforth, though, be called the G League, G as in Gatorade, which has bought the naming rights. The NBA is hoping Gatorade throws its marketing weight around and gets more people in the stands. That might happen or it might not, but come on, man, another corporate branding play in consumer life? Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
Major League Baseball has the minors. The NBA has the Developmental League. The NBA's New York Knicks play at Madison Square Garden, capacity 20,000. The Westchester Knicks, one of the 22 D-League franchises, play at the Westchester County Center. The capacity there is 2,000. Jim Andrews, senior vice president at the marketing firm IEG, says there are a lot of benefits for the D-League.
They get a partner in Gatorade that is very good at promotion and advertising, and that's something that the former D-League, now the G-League, really could use.
For its part, Gatorade gets a title sponsorship, and it can use the Developmental League as a research and development playground. Jeff Kearney is global head of sports marketing at Gatorade.
We're going to have an embedded presence in this league to really play some offense and be proactive and incubate products and equipment.
Gatorade and the NBA will be able to develop original marketing content like videos of players testing the equipment too. Ken Shropshire is a sports business professor at the Wharton School. He says the NBA can use this as an experiment as well.
To see how the public reacts to it and to see if the money is worth it, just to see if there's a deliverable that comes by adding a corporate name to the name of the league.
Because there's got to be a point of branding exhaustion. Seems like everything nowadays is brought to you by something or somebody. And it's tough for marketers to keep up. Just ask folks trying to sell TV ads. If you can fast forward through them, you're probably going to do it. So do we really need something like the Coca-Cola NBA Finals?
You can't do it.
That's Ben Sterner. He's the founder of Leverage Agency, a sports marketing firm.
You can't take over something that hasn't been taken over for a long time, like the NBA Finals, where you have 6 or 7 or 8, you know, corporate partners who, you know, they're all paying 7 figures, and you know, it's going to be hard to differentiate.
The NBA is trying different tactics beyond what it's doing in the D League. Next season, a few teams will have advertisements on the upper left corner of players' jerseys, less in your face than what you see in European soccer, but it is more branding. Patrick Risch is director of the sports business program at Washington University in St. Louis.
The sports consumer will adapt just as they adapted to dynamic ticket pricing. They'll adapt to this, though some purists may say that they are. We'll see how they feel 2 or 3 years from now. I doubt they'll raise a fuss then.
Neither the NBA nor Gatorade would say how they're going to know if the partnership is paying off, and there's no guarantee it will. Again, Jim Andrews at IEG.
There have been some examples of sports governing bodies, leagues that have tried this and who have turned around and decided not to do it.
Like women's professional tennis in the U.S. and Premier League soccer in the U.K. Andrews says this deal is different. It's easier to try it out in the D-League, where there are relatively few sponsors and therefore fewer potential conflicts, like watching a Gatorade NBA game with players on the L.A. Lakers sporting Powerade ads on their jerseys. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a quick shout out to the folks at Slate for their Wayne Tracker name generator. You might have seen that New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has accused now Secretary of State Rex Tillerson of using a fake email address with a pseudonym to talk about climate change while Tillerson was the CEO of ExxonMobil. Wayne Tracker was the pseudonym in question, apparently a combination of Tillerson's middle name, Wayne, and something having to do with him having been an Eagle Scout when he was a kid. Anyway, Slate took that and ran with it. You enter first, middle, and last name in their widget. It spits out your Texas Oilman code name. Sadly, I don't have a middle name, so I'm just Kai Rawhide, which it just doesn't work, right? Holy cow, we got to go. The Dow off 44 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 18 points, 0.3%. S&P 500 down 8. 0.3%. Janet Yellen tomorrow. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rawhide. We're back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.